Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in to In the Same Vein, a podcast from the Department of Health Humanities and Bioethics at the University of Rochester. My name is Christy Slobogan, and I am an assistant professor in that department.
And my name is Priya Mandava. I'm a second-year medical student at the University of Rochester School of Medicine.
So today we are talking to Dr. Jay Baruch, and we had such a wonderful conversation with him.
Dr. Baruch is a professor of emergency medicine at Alpert Medical School of Brown University, where he serves as the director of the Medical Humanities and Bioethics Scholarly Concentration. He is a practicing emergency physician, writer, medical educator, and academic. Today, we'll be talking about Dr. Baruch's book, Tornado of Life, A Doctor's Journey Through Constraints and Creativity in the ER, published in MIT Press in fall 2022. He has also written two books of short fiction, What's Left Out and 14 Stories, Doctors, Patients, and Other Strangers. His short fiction and essays have appeared in various medical and literary journals and lay media outlets, including the Boston Globe, Stat, New England Journal of Medicine, Academic Medicine, and CNN.
So we're mostly talking about the book Tornado of Life, but we're using this book to talk about the importance of stories in healthcare, particularly, of course, in emergency medicine. We talk about the concept of the chaos narrative, which is a really fascinating concept from Arthur Frank. We talk about bringing the humanities into medical education. We talk about the role and expression of compassion in medicine. And we touch upon a lot of the particular vignettes that are found in Tornado of Life.
So I personally was really excited to talk with Dr. Baruch and just discuss his book with him, because as someone with an undergraduate background in public health, I've just always been passionate about the power of narrative and understanding both individuals and communities. This approach has guided me in thinking about how we shape policies and practices that not only serve the collective, but remain adaptable to the needs of the individual themselves. This all kind of compounded with my interest in education, particularly medical education, has shaped the kind of clinician I personally am hoping to grow into. That is why I was beyond thrilled to have the opportunity to speak with Dr. Baruch, whose work so clearly illustrates the importance of these very concepts. In his book, The Tornado of Life, Dr. Baruch brings to life the dynamic balance between understanding the complexities of the human experience with responding effectively in healthcare and education, truly highlighting that interplay between the art and science of medicine.
Yeah, that's really beautifully said, and we hope that you enjoy this episode.
Okay, so first question, just to get us started. We wanted to start with a fairly basic question about narrative and emergency medicine. You write at the start of the book, "My work as an emergency physician has always struck me as a fundamentally creative act," and we really want to hear more about this. You explain so well in Tornado of Life the roles of stories in emergency medicine, but could you just summarize for our listeners what that role specifically is? And how writing them down helps you personally as a physician?
Yeah, sure. That's a wonderful question. And it's a big question. There's a lot of little questions inside that big question. I'll tell you what attracted me to emergency medicine initially was the story element. And what I mean by that, there was something incredibly meaningful about going into work and meeting a whole bunch of people that I previously did not know, with a host of different complaints and problems and fears and anxieties. They were really complex humans, right? And they didn't necessarily come in like a question stem on a test, right? Giving you a list of issues and it's your job is to have an answer. Oftentimes they're just telling you their life, telling you their challenges, sharing their fears and anxieties. Sometimes they're not saying much of anything, and you have to respect those silences and know when to ask different types of questions. It felt to me, before I knew what to do as far as ordering tests or responding to their challenges or their problems or maybe even venturing a diagnosis, I first had to understand what their problem was. And the only way to get to that is through their story. Like, that is the fundamental bedrock of what emergency medicine is.
Thank you so much for that. We're over here just nodding along to everything that you're saying. So we really appreciate that. And yeah, all of those stories, the importance of those stories really comes through in the book, especially since, you know, they're kind of bite-sized chapters. You really get a sense of how many stories you might interact with on a day and how in the emergency room and how different each of them are from one another and how unique. I'm afraid that we have another large question. I know that first one was
excellent. That's awesome. Bring it on.
This one is a multi-parter as well. I will say it was really hard to write simple questions for such a, you know, complex book.
Well, the thing is, like, that was amazing, right? Because that's really what this, part of what this book tries to reveal, which is like the inquiry is the thing, right? Once you start asking yourself questions and you sort of step back and you're curious and you're asking why, and then you're diving into that a little bit deeper and you're asking, well, why is that? Why do I think that? Why am I paying attention to this bit of information and not that bit of information? And you realize that understanding how to navigate that inquiry is just so critical to what we do as clinicians, and it's critical for what we do as human beings. We understand ourselves, we understand each other, we understand the world through stories. For me, emergency medicine is complex humans caring for complex humans. And it just so happens to take place in a health space with particular sense of urgency and needs and time constraints.
Absolutely. I really appreciate that kind of addition to the first question about stories. Okay, so here's our second big complex question then. This is kind of about the general theme of chaos, which of course comes up in emergency medicine quite a lot. So could you explain to our listeners, though, what a quote-unquote chaos narrative is? This was a really helpful framework, I thought, at the beginning of the book. And then part two of the question. Actually, could you just answer the first part of that question first, and then I'll come back to it. Just could you explain what a chaos narrative is and how it helped you kind of frame Tornado of Life?
So I can't take any credit for the term chaos narrative or the framing of the chaos narrative. That belongs to Arthur Frank, who wrote an extraordinary book called The Wounded Storyteller, which was one of my two sort of seminal touchstones when I started thinking about the bridges between clinical work and medicine, perhaps academic work in the humanities, the other one being Doctor Stories by Catherine Montgomery Hunter. And, you know, what Art lays out with these three, I don't want to call them three categories, but sort of these three overlapping frames are not distinct. They're sort of like a Venn diagram with overlap and morphing into one side versus, you know, into each category. But there's a chaos narrative, there's a restitution narrative, and a request narrative. And these are sort of framing of healthcare experiences and how sort of the healthcare system sort of processes and thinks about the experiences that patients have go through. Arthur Frank is a survivor of prostate cancer. I say that because he has written rather, you know, so eloquently and about it. So I'll put the chaos narrative in context of three other narratives. I think it's really important. So how Art puts it is that medicine essentially operates from a frame of sort of a restitution narrative, which is like you have a problem, you're well, something goes wrong, you take the pill, you get the treatment, and then suddenly you return back to your normal state. You have the sniffles, you have the acid digestion, you take the purple pill, and the next thing I know, like, you're out having that spaghetti dinner, like, the next night, which is what the commercial says. The quest narrative is a little bit different. And the quest narrative takes its premise from Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey. And in a quest narrative, you have someone who is well. And then you get pushed into this other place. Your world is different. And you face challenges and you face turbulence. And you discover things along the way. As a result of your struggles, if you are so fortunate to return, you come back, but you're a different person. Like, that experience has changed you. ARP uses this narrative to understand a lot of, like, cancer survivors' narratives, which you sort of come back, but sometimes what you've gone through, you can't even explain to the people who are closest to you, the people that you love. And so you come back, you're ill, you get pushed into this other world, you come back, but somehow things have changed because of that experience. Then there's the chaos narrative. And the chaos narrative, if you think about narrative as a sense of sort of getting order on experiences, a chaos narrative are those experiences that there is no framing. Like, sometimes you can't even find language for certain experiences. I see a lot of ER patients that sort of feel that fit into that chaos narrative framework. And oftentimes you can sense what a chaos narrative, because it feels like, and then this happened, and then, and then, and then, and then. And you're like, oh my God, like, what is going on here? Because there's no order to it. And they can be very frustrating to providers. It can be very frustrating to the patients, because how do you articulate an experience that is really difficult to articulate, to find language for? The reason why it's so critical is that the worst thing you can do for a patient telling you a chaos narrative is to try to turn it into a restitution narrative, to try to take a complex, challenging situation that has no answer, that might even be so hard to even express, to then say, okay, just do this and this, to give an answer because it makes you feel more comfortable that you're giving them something. And the most important thing you need to do as clinicians is to sit with it and let them talk and give them space and honor the narrative. Don't feel the need that you have to have a response. What you need to do is show dignity and respect the fact that sometimes patients and people have experiences that is hard to wrap your hands around. And that's why I wrote about that in the piece with Cheryl L., Tornado of Life. And why that piece was so important for me, because at that time, because that was a patient that happened a long, long time ago, it was one of those moments when some conceptual work in the humanities had real clinical application for me. When I've spoken with others, when I've given presentations and talks, and I talk about this, I often am surprised, because of all the things that you think are a little bit abstract for clinicians, I had so many of my residents, emergency medicine residents, the first time I gave a talk on this that included this framing, like that week, they were like, you know, I had this patient and I was getting really frustrated, or I didn't know what to do. And I realized they're telling me a chaos narrative. It's not about me. And it provided them some comfort and I think actually permission to just be human.
That was so helpful for, I think, our understanding and our listeners' understanding just of the overall context. So thank you so much for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad that we've now split this out into two questions about chaos, because that needed its own question. So really appreciate you laying that out.
And I will add as a little bit of addition that because of, you know, I love it when certain pieces of certain works just speak to you. And Wounded Storyteller is just a fantastic book. And I love that book on so many different levels. And I've actually alluded to ARP's work in a couple of pieces that I've written. And he actually said that to me once he reached out and totally blew my mind. It was like, oh my God, I'm actually in contact with Arthur Frank. And he said that because he was just so happy that, you know, that like the work resonated on a very applicable human level. I think that's what all this work did have some grounding in real world challenges.
And, you know, as faculty in a health humanities department, hearing, you know, these very clear applications of humanities theories to the clinical world is just, we love to hear that. That's what we want to hear all the time. And so this is a great kind of example for one of those instances.
I think the humanities, I mean, years ago when I was younger and snarkier, I had a medical school associate dean involved in education ask me about, well, where do we fit the humanities in our curriculum? You know, what would a curriculum look like? And I sort of whipped something together. I was younger and a little bolder, a little bit more idealistic. And the response was, this is really great. And even somebody who supported the humanities, this is really great. Where do we put it? Like, where do we find room for this? Being the young, stocky person that I was, said, you know, I essentially think that medical education should be the humanities with all the relevant scientific stuff sprinkled in. I think it's critical to what we do. I mean, it's absolutely critical. It's my framing of the humanities and a lot of the emergency medicine work that I do is essentially like humanities and narrative are clinical skills. Like they're clinical skills and with applications that are just as important as procedures. So I just want to get on my little platform and out that out for a little bit of a detour.
Sorry. Oh, please. You are preaching to the choir here, and I love it. I love it. This is what we say all the time in our department and around the University of Rochester, you know, medical school, medical center. You know, it's important to try to embed ourselves as much as we can in medical education and kind of advocate for the importance of this kind of material, this kind of education, and, you know, things like this podcast and having students engage with work like yours. Yeah, again, this is my soapbox too, so I appreciate you standing up here with me. So that's nice. I want to go back to that idea of chaos again, just briefly, because I thought it was really interesting, like thinking about style of writing. You know, at the beginning of the book, you talk about how you had at first wanted to make the book kind of disorienting, like an emergency department or emergency room. And then you ended up not writing Tornado of Life in that style. So I wanted to hear more about what motivated that decision and what would that even have looked like? What would those tactics have been?
Thank you for that question, because I still think it possesses a little non-linearity that is sort of unexpected necessarily in certain books, especially books by physician writers. I will confess that became a little bit less chaotic under the thumb of my editor, who I absolutely adore. And we had great conversations in framing what the book was like. And so to give you an idea about how it originally was conceived, with just all these pieces, and I didn't even have an introduction. I just sort of jumped right in. And my editor said, it was, why don't you like your readers? And I go, I love my readers. He goes, I know you do, but you can't just do this. He goes, you have to give some kind of grounding. You have to give some kind of framing, because this is just like too much. You can't just plop. Because I really just wanted to like plop the reader in the middle of it and have the form of the book echo the content. Like I wanted the reader to feel that. However, that's not always a great feeling unless you have it over the guns. So there were some early readers of the book who, you know, really, you know, agreed. Like there should be like, what could we get some bare minimum structure? And I look at it as more as grounding. So the reader understands a little bit about what the book is trying to do without being too explicit as to letting the book have the legs and take them into the experience. There were a couple of books that sort of helped me frame this book that I sort of used as, I don't want to say models, but emotional models. Like I responded to these books in a particular way. One is pretty well known, which is Tim O'Brien's Things I Carried. And I loved the way the book operated on several different levels, and that people can't even decide whether it's a book of short stories, whether it's a novel, and does it really matter? But it takes you into an intense experience, and essentially it's a book about storytelling. It's about how we process and understand stories and the role of stories in our life. But I love that idea of it. I love the fact that I didn't know quite what I was getting myself into with each piece, how they resonated and bounced off each other in a particular way. And I read another book, which is less well known, that should be very well known. And it's a book called Heating and Cooling by Beth Ann Benelli, who did run the writing program, MFA program at University of Mississippi. And it's a book of like 52 micro memoirs. And it's essentially about her, you know, her family, her life. But it's so beautiful. It's so funny. And you just capture a life. You capture an experience. You capture personalities. And I love the way you sort of like, you hold up, like each piece holds a different side of an experience. And as a reader, you piece things together. Like you're leaving room for the reader to step into it. And that's what I wanted to do, because I was struggling so much with these pieces, to the result of me struggling and trying to understand experiences and it manifested in writing. I wanted that struggle to somehow come through without necessarily making the reader feel the struggle.
I think that really did come through the writing. As I was reading it, I felt elements of that, of kind of being pulled in multiple directions and the complexity of each and every one of those interactions. So while I can appreciate that your editor was trying to look out for us, I also do think that the way you communicated through your writing, it was very much felt by all the readers.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to have an editor, Bob Pryor, who was just wonderful. And he was a bear. Like we really had some really, some great discussions back and forth, but that really made the book better. I mean, I won a few things, he won a few things, we conceded on a bunch of things, but it was really great to have someone pushing you, you know, to make certain that what you were doing and how you were doing it was for a reason. Can you explain this? Can you articulate your motivation, your purpose, what you're hoping to achieve, why you're doing this? And they were details that you don't necessarily have to go through sort of in a sort of creative nonfiction, a straight creative nonfiction book. And the fact that he allowed me to do that, that MIT Press allowed me to do that, I was very, very fortunate.
You've spoken a lot about the power and importance of a story. And I think we would just really like to hear what your journey was to take those stories that you've heard and start capturing them through your writing. Has writing always been a part of your life, or did that become more central to you as you became a clinician?
No, I was an English major, literature person from the beginning. I always thought, I mean, I don't understand it. Like, there's certain things you just can't explain, right? You can't just rationalize. I just always wanted to be in literature. I thought I was going to be an English professor. I went to college to be an English professor and to hopefully be a writer. And I never thought I'd get into medical school. I think I wanted to go into medicine. Particular course in college that involved going to a local hospital, you know, visit different wards of the hospital. Someone would babysit us and make sure we didn't get into trouble. But one week we were with the pastoral service, and we spent the afternoon and an oncology wing. And I remember sitting there with this gentleman who was dying of cancer. And we just spoke for like 2 hours. And it was so extraordinarily meaningful for me. I mean, it was very illuminating to be that young, to be talking to somebody like this, who you don't even know, who's sharing experiences and insights that you can never get in a book, right? You can't put that down. The surprise of it all was part of the profundity of it. It gave me a different insight and perspective on how I want to work with stories. And I realized that I was intrigued by medicine. I always, like, you know, I loved MASH. I loved some of these classic shows. but it felt like incredibly necessary at that, starting at that moment. I go, well, you know, I can use my skills. I want to relate to stories in this very tactile, granular way, not in an abstract way. I want to be able to have the training and the skills to be able to act on these stories to help this people like this gentleman. And that sort of set the wheel turning, you know, so it was a gradual thing, but that was the window that opened for me and my journey.
That is such a great story. And I feel like this comes up a lot, you know, when asking folks what led them to their career. So often it's one class in college that kind of changed things. You know, I was an art history and English double major in college, and I took an art and medicine class. And I was like, oh, this is it. Seeing how the visual is applied in medical practice and throughout the history of medicine, I was like, this is what feels right for me. And here I am working in a medical center, however many years later. So I really appreciate that.
You know, what's so great about that story is the openness of it, right? Like you're mm-hmm. open to it, and you think about the experiences we all have, probably not infrequently, that we're just close to it because I think it's important, it's not relevant, we're focused, our attention is elsewhere. To be aware of that tingling in you, or to be aware that what's resisting you or what's like getting you to go, like that's equally important. That curiosity and that receptivity and that capacity for wonder is something that is almost childlike, right? That we sort of lose as adults. But that was so great about your story, is that you were open to that. Like you were aware of that experience and its impact on the direction that you might take.
Yeah, I mean, same with yours. I want to ask, I kind of shift gears a little bit and ask a specific question about something that you mentioned in the book. So we had an episode on this podcast last year in the first season about resource allocation, specifically about ventilator allocation during the height of COVID, which is, of course, a time period that you write about a lot in the book. And so I was thinking a lot about this idea of resource allocation when you talked about compassion as something that can be allocated in your book. And so can you talk about why this is a quote unquote resource in the ER, and how do you keep replenishing this when your job requires so much of it?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I don't necessarily think that compassion is a resource the same way like a ventilator is a resource. You have a ventilator, you have space in the ICU, you have something that's tactile and tangible, and it's a constraint. And you could all agree upon what that is, right? And like, you know, there's so many different definitions of what compassion is and its role. And, one sort of basic idea about compassion that I sort of found useful in my thinking about its scarcity or its fragility is that it's like understanding or recognizing a patient's situation, perspective, and their emotions, and the ability and the desire to communicate and to act, right? It's the act part, to do something, to respond, to not just to sort of, okay, it's, you feel that way and leave it unattended. And I have a problem when people talk about the loss of compassion. And I'll tell you what the problem is. I'll give you a story. So years ago, we had, you know, you get all these evaluations of, you know, various departments and stuff. And there was a meeting with people, administrators, people, some experts, consultants coming down and talking about, you know, ways to sort of improve, the emergency department operations like they do in every emergency department. And I started with a card, you know, what do you think is an important thing that we should be paying attention to? And what you can do more of? And and people handed in cards, and their frequent answer was, I could be more compassionate. And this person threw away the line that goes, yes, we have to remember, we must be more compassionate. We must have more compassion. And I said, no, that's not the question. And, you know, I got these weird looks. And I said, because I work with everybody here, and everybody here is compassionate. But I think the question is, what are the pressures? What are the challenges? What are the situations that makes people who are otherwise compassionate behave in ways that are not, that they are them? That's us. I mean, I can be compassionate and lack compassion in the same ship. And so how does that happen? Like one of those pressures, then it really changes. Okay, what do we mean by compassion? And what way does the environment impact that? And so the way that I write about compassion involves a couple of directions of compassion. Like, so one is, how do we care for so many people at the same time? It's really easy to point to like one person and say, okay, I'm going to care for that. But how do I care for 20 patients equally? And do I feel something, especially with you have challenging patients, people who maybe are distrusting, maybe people who are just difficult, maybe people who are just terrified, the physical environment, which you might be, you know, I wish things could be better. I wish there could be more privacy. I wish I could be more time. I'm too quick. And so there's compassionate scale. Like, how do I be compassionate at scale? And then there are the conditions, like such that I wrote in the book about the situation of, you know, you have a waiting room full of people. You have in the middle of the night, you have a freezing night outside. And you have like no open beds because there's ER boarding in your hospital. So basically it's pretty much most of the ER is filled with admitted patients who should be up on the floor, but there are no beds on the floor. This happened, you know, years ago. And then you have someone who is in a stable housing, has an alcohol use disorder, comes in once or twice a day, has exhausted a lot of resources. Like, do you discharge them in the middle of the night? They might go into withdrawal, which is require medication, keep them there longer. Do they get discharged into the cold night with the risks of the environment and hypothermia? But then what about the 30, 40, 50, 60 people who are out in the waiting room? And that's why I sort of talked about sort of like compassion confusion, because you didn't know what direction to allocate your compassion. So depending upon where you're standing, I might be considered compassionately keeping that gentleman the night to sleep until morning. And other people might say, yeah, but how about these other sick people, potentially really sick people who are sitting in the waiting room? That's hard to reconcile. And I think what's interesting is that when that chapter first came out in a Zip Reformer's an article, I heard a lot from readers from, you know, all types. And I heard, thank you so much for describing this challenge, because, you know, it's really hard, and I'm glad you put it out there. And it took me years to write that. I got to tell you, it took me years to struggle to sort of get that out in an appropriate way. And I also had people say, you are a cold and heartless doctor. And I know, I mean, I get it. And that's why I wrote the piece. Because there are no satisfactory answers, but I think we have to talk about it.
I think that as a current student who's working into not only learning all of the anatomy, physiology, that aspect of medicine, but what kind of clinician do I want to be? And when I step into a room as a provider, what do I want my patients to take away from that experience? Obviously, I would love to fix their broken bone, but as you're describing so much, a lot of times that's not the only issue they're coming in with, or that's not really what they're hoping to leave with. And I think a struggle that I've often been confronted with, even in just the learning process, is where do you find that balance of there's the community as a whole, there's an individual. There's not always a synergy between the two. And so how do I properly exercise the platform and responsibility I feel like I hold as a clinician in that environment? Where do I exercise compassion? What does that come out as? What is my intention versus how does it present? And what are people taking away from that? I think that can really be its own almost mess in my head, or its own confusion a lot of the time, of what's really happening here, when I really want to help, and I just don't always know the best way to do so. So I think you putting words to that and showing that you're going to try your best and you're going to work towards supporting those as best as you can. People may receive it in different ways, and that's a reality we have to face. But as long as I am intentionally putting my work towards supporting those in the best way that I can, that is a way to move forward, kind of in this sphere and every sphere in life.
That's so beautiful. I really is. That's so lovely. That acknowledgement, again, getting back to sort of the questions that lead to other questions, creating space to even voice that, right, is so critical, because it's something that I think so many of us feel. But I've learned that, you know, clinicians, physicians, nurses, at least the ER staff that I work with, of all stripes, they're caring people, and we're not perfect. And when things happen, when we say something, when we feel like we haven't cared enough, or we feel we could have been done better, we could have been kinder, I could not have cut that person off. Maybe not at all. Maybe I should have let that person talk a little bit more. I definitely should have let that patient talk a little bit more. Is to acknowledge that, to recognize that, to interrogate your behavior, saying, God, you know, why did I cut that patient off? What was I thinking? Was I uncomfortable with what they were saying? Was there something that was else going on in my head? Was it the three other patients I need to get to? And then what happens is then you can go back. And so if you do cut them off and you recognize, you go back and you say, hey, sorry, you know, I feel like I cut you off. What else can I do for you? And so it's a process, requires a recognition and forgiveness. I think we're really hard on ourselves. That I think students in particular who just feel like they should know what to do. It's really hard to realize that, you know what, there's so many elements and dimensions of the practice of medicine that we have to forgive ourselves. We're not going to be perfect. And we aren't. Like, we're not. I find that when patients sort of recognize you struggling with them, there's a sense of kinship. Like, what's this? It's not the fact that I don't know what's going on with you, like I can't give you an answer. It's not like, oh, I don't know. It's like, this is what I do know, and this is what I'm thinking. And when you leave here, this is like, let's have a plan or something, or the beginning of a plan. So you're thinking about them, what's going to happen like the next day when you turn the page on their story, right? And I, especially nowadays when they feel that patients just feel ignored, you know, there are so many prompts and machines and it's so tough to talk to a human, to have that capacity to actually be face-to-face with another human is priceless.
I completely agree. And I think that really segues a little bit into our next question. Because when we were first meeting to discuss the book, we both mentioned how impactful the hug story was. Essentially, you had a dilemma of whether or not to hug a patient when they requested one. We were really struck by you saying that the hug was, quote unquote, a morally suspect gesture, and that you felt that you weren't hugging her, but were, quote, hugging her loneliness, a life spinning out of control. Could you just explain a little bit about why you feel that this specific story was important to tell?
It was one of the earliest pieces that I had, sort of a creed or nonfiction form. And so two things happened as part of the origin story of me getting this piece together. One was medical education discussion, which was about hugging and like the important to hug your patient if they want to hug you. And yeah, I think it's great, you know, but then we ended up having like last a decade later, and then we had like Me Too, and we had a lot of other, you know, societal changes, and then we had COVID and what the role of touch and lack of touch and what that meant. But at the time, you know, that discussion was out there about like the importance of hugging. And I realized that there were patients that I hugged then who wanted a hug, and I gave them a hug, and that they were patients, you know, for whatever reason, as I write this piece, that, you know, you're a little bit less, you're less certain about whether you want to hug them, why you want to hug them, what the implication of that hug is, what hugs symbolize in general. And then I had a patient who was, so she was someone with sort of unstable housing, substance use disorder back in the day, just pulled in and sweeping in the wrong place, making a little bit of a scene, animated. I go in, and like one of the first things she says is like, you know, give me a hug. And I realized that it's just a simple thing, a hug. And then I felt like, you know, this patient, he has unstable housing. She was a little bit, you know, she was a little bit jittery. We had no interaction. Like, that was like the first thing she wanted. And she seemed very genuine about the whole thing. And so I hugged her because I felt like, God, you know, what if I don't hug her? That's like an awful thing than to say, no, I don't want to. And I felt really like, oh my God, I was so torn. I'm like, oh, this is like a medical dilemma right now where all it has to do is a hug. I went back and I was talking to one of the residents. I go, yeah, I hugged the patient, you know, room, whatever. And they're like, you hugged her? And I go, of course. And they're like, yeah, she asked me to hug. And I said, no way. And then one of the nurses is like, yeah, she asked me to hug. I said, they're professional boundaries. And I was like, oh my God. And so that led to just a lot of, like, most, like, almost everything I write. It's just me trying to understand the situation. You know, and the way I process information, the way I process experience is just writing about it, not for publication necessarily, it's for me. That's how I feel like I haven't really fully processed a moment or an experience or a challenging situation unless I've written through it. It's like a mode of thinking, processing experience, and what happens when you move your hand across the page. But I loved it because it was such a simple thing that was a moral problem. Like, it was a big ethical dilemma. And I felt like the stakes were high because it's about sort of human contact, human interaction. There's someone who's been otherwise rejected at different levels, lost to the system, you know, estranged from family, that sort of thing that I had. And then I'm not gonna hug her. That's like terrible. And so I'm glad I did. And though, as I write in the piece, it was more like she hugged me than I hugged her. That's the beauty. That's the beauty of medicine, like those little moments that really are profound in their own way.
We both really did feel that when we read that particular section of the book. It did feel quite profound. Staying on this kind of theme of specific patients, as I was reading the book, I kept wondering about the differences between each stories and what names patients were given. You know, some got first names, some got last initials, some got titles like Mr. and Mrs. And I couldn't quite figure out the rationale for that. And then you addressed it towards the end of the book, which I really appreciated. So thank you for that. But in this section towards the end, you talk about privacy laws and moral codes. But more importantly, I think you talk about your own personal framework for approaching patient stories and identities. So could you talk us through your decision-making process for giving patient names or other identifying features and how you keep yourself accountable as you're writing and as you're trying to both protect them and to tell their stories truthfully?
So that was a very intentional decision on my part because, you know, often in books, you know, which involve patients, there's like a little disclaimer, you know, in the front, and, you know, all identifiable details were altered and, you know, other sort of legalese. I didn't feel that that was enough. And I felt that it was important to actually include it in the narrative, flow of the narrative, because it is a critical question, because I am a physician and I'm a writer. And how do I, so for years, I didn't write about medicine at all. You know, I wrote fiction. I wrote two books in short fiction. And I had fun with that. I love that. What the imagination allows you to do and the directions that you would lead you towards that you never really expected. And of course, you're limited when you're grounded in the real world. And one of the reasons why I moved in this direction was a lot of people were doing it. I think some people were doing it very responsibly and some people perhaps less so. A lot of it had to do with the growth of social media and blogging and different types of communication outlets. I always try to be responsible about it. So I will walk through sort of like my framing of sort of how I create these narratives. And first of all, like, there's nothing that I'm doing that I write about that says, I'm going to write about this. There are a couple of pieces that are related to tangential to COVID that are more in the moment that I assessed they were going to end up seeing public eyes. But literally everything I write evolves out of some kind of grappling with the situation, usually some kind of ethical problem, moral dilemma. And I'm writing about it. And not just writing about what happened, I'm writing about my feelings. I'm writing about what if. What if that happens? You know, I'm really glad this is what I wanted to say to that patient. But what if I did say that and play that out? And it's a way to sort of play with different narrative possibilities, but it also allows you to pay attention differently, right? And it allows you to get very granular and to see things differently and to see things from their perspective in a way, if you allow yourself to do that. And I think a lot of my previous work in creative writing and shifting perspectives and moving narratives around and looking at it from very different points of view allows me to sort of do that a little bit more. Those wheels are a little bit greased more, perhaps, than someone with a more journalistic background. When I decide that something is going to sort of become a piece, I'm like, okay, what is it that I'm trying to say? And what part of this is about me? What part of it is really about the patient? And what dimensions of this narrative involve both of us? And then I'm like, okay, what is it that can be left out or changed? What is critical to what I'm trying to say? And I'll omit certain things. Then I'll say, okay, so it's really important that this person has end stage lung cancer, for example. Well, you know what? Can I change the cancer to make it, because the cancer is not really as relevant. It's just the fact the person, you know, has a critical, you know, has a cancer that's critical, for example. I might change a few things like that, but that happens with each draft. But I try to preserve what is absolutely critical. So the facts stay the same. You know, I have bits of dialogue, I have bits of things that are grounded, that are real. But each editorial draft involves really interrogating the piece. So whatever is in that piece is essential and hopefully respectful and honors the patient. And so what I try to do is pretend that they're looking over my shoulder. If this patient read this, would they say, you know what, you did a good job of trying to respecting my perspective, my feelings? And oftentimes the person who really gets the sharp end of things in my pieces is me. You know, so what information belongs to them alone? I leave that out. What information belongs to both of us? What sort of shared custody? And what things need to be left out entirely because they're too tender or fragile or might be easily recognizable? And it's really in the multiple editorializing, the editorial process of like rewriting and rewriting and rewriting.
I really appreciate that process, and it seems like it's something you put a lot of thought into when you're thinking about what to write and how to represent it. So really appreciate that. Kind of for our last question here, we're going to shift gears a little bit towards medical education. Like I said, I'm a bit biased as a medical student, so I was thinking a little bit as I was reading the book about the implications for medical education itself. I feel that often we're taught that we need to know the answer, but you so often focus about the role of uncertainty throughout your life and just in your role as a clinician. So I was wondering a little bit, how do you think we should teach openness to ambiguity and uncertainty when we're training future clinicians?
The easy answer is sort of the arts and the humanities. The nuts and bolts is beginning with the fact that you have to know things. You know, like I write about not knowing in my book, the importance of not knowing, but before you sort of can honor and be good at not knowing, because you have to know things. So like I wrote a piece for Academic Medicine years ago, and in it, the editor was like, you have to write, like, I like the idea of not knowing, but you have to write that it's important that medical students know things. Like, oh, yes, I got to be explicit about that. So you have to know things. But then it's really generating a curiosity, the fact that, yes, we have tests, we have to assess your knowledge base, your abilities to think through issues, but also, you know, we have to create space and create forgiveness. In fact, there are things that you will not know. We do work with the, we've done work with the RISD, Royal Institute of Design Art Museum. We do something different than sort of standard pedagogical work in the visual arts. But we use paintings and works of art as complex bodies of information. And you need to sort of understand like how you see and how you think. And what's interesting is that one of the criticisms that has been justly lavish on medicine is the lack of time with patients. And I agree like 150%. But I don't think a lack of time is the entire issue. Because we've done work in front of works of art where clinicians, residents, seasoned attendings, ER attending, will sit before a work of art for 45 minutes. And for the first question or two, we'll ask a question, an open question, and they'll just sit there. And no one's responding. There's no right answer. These are very smart people. These are brilliant people. Some of them are actually brilliant artists as well. And it's the fact that we're not used to sort of being open-minded and just putting it out there and to being vulnerable and be recognizing that there is no right answer, be comfortable with that. And I had one attending who's brilliant, a colleague of mine, who during one session, we're like, why was it so quiet in the beginning? Because we break down halfway through, we sort of interrogate what we've just done. And they were like, I feel like I have to know the answer. I feel very uncomfortable not having the answer. So then what? So you have to then say, how do we create those opportunities to say, okay, you know, there are times you need to know the answer. If someone comes in with a heart attack, I should identify a heart attack and act on that quickly. But a lot of what I deal with, there are no answers. I don't even know what the right questions are. But how do I learn to ask the right questions? How do I know that I don't know? You know, it's a process of interrogation and reflection. And I feel like it can happen in the clinical space, though I feel like sometimes it's too quick and people are rushed. They get so many things done. But I do feel that's the central role for the arts. I hope that the humanities doesn't get so pedagogically oriented towards outcomes that it takes away from the power of what the arts provides, which is exploration and discovery. And sometimes the very power of the arts can't be measured. There's no way to measure it. There's no measured outcomes for it other than the thing itself. So sometimes the optimal outcome for arts and clinical education is the process itself.
Absolutely. And obviously, as an art historian, I love that we ended on that visual arts example. But I just want to thank you so much for having this conversation with us. It was fascinating and really, really wonderful. So yeah, we really appreciate it, both Priya and I.
Yes, thank you so much for your book, the way that you articulate not only your patient stories, but also your own, I think, is just such a treat to read and listen to. So thank you so much.